The Supreme Court starts its new term on Monday, and since Congress still hasn't moved to hold hearings or vote on President Obama's nominee for the court, Merrick Garland, a second term with just 8 justices is about to begin. For more now on the coming term, the great NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us from Washington. Hi, Nina.
Thank you for the accolade.
Well, of course. And thank you for being here. And another term begins without a ninth justice. Are we already seeing that absence impact the term, even though it hasn't even started yet?
Well, we certainly are. There are fewer cases. We can discuss that in a minute. But if you want to look at what the next term is going to be like, you look at what the last term was like, or most of the last term. And that is, there were a record number of tie votes, 4, and that means that the lower court decision stands for the moment but sets no national precedent. And many cases were decided on the narrowest of grounds. And Justice Elena Kagan recently said in an appearance at Harvard that what that meant was that the court was deciding virtually nothing in these cases, that they sliced the salami so thin so that they could finally compromise and agree on something, that they weren't deciding the question that they had initially taken the case to decide. And she said, you know, in the long run, that's really not good. That's not what they're there to do. They're there to resolve conflicts in the lower courts so that there are national rules that govern how we run our country legally.
Fair to say, though, that the 4-4 ties have, for the most part, so far benefited the liberal wing of the court.
No, that's actually not true. The 4-4 ties last term, 2 of them benefited the liberal wing, 2 of them benefited the conservative wing. So the immigration 4-4 tie essentially killed off the Obama immigration plan to shield the parents of children who are American citizens when the parents are deportable and to prevent the parents from being deported. So that's dead in its tracks until a later time, and when the next president either revives it, uses it, tests it, whatever, gets rid of it. But that was definitely a loss for the liberal wing of the court.
So the justices yesterday took on 8 new cases for the coming term, bringing the total number so far to 31. How does that compare to past years?
As you said, 31 so far this term. Typically, the court hears about 80 cases a term, and even that number is about half of what it was when I first started covering the court in the dark ages. But so far, as I said, 31. Last year, it was 43 at this time. Hmm. So I asked my intern, because I'm incapable of this, to calculate for me what the percentage fewer cases is. And she tells me 28%, so don't hold me to it. But
well, and none of the cases seem to be particularly divisive, though, right? No real hot-button issues in the coming term?
Well, there are some, but it's very interesting. Most of the real hot-button issues were granted, if you call them that, they were granted before Scalia died, when there was a full court and when there was a clear 5-justice conservative majority on a bunch of issues. And now there isn't. And what they're doing is putting off the most controversial of those until later in the term, hoping against hope that maybe they'll have a 9th justice by then, and not scheduling them now when they would normally be scheduled early in the term because they were granted before Scalia died last February.
So the new justice, if and when we get one, will just be able to deal with cases that come up after that justice goes to the court.
That's correct, unless they schedule something that's already been argued for re-argument. They can do that in this term. They could schedule it for a re-argument next term. But unless there actually is a justice sitting there waiting to rehear a case or to hear a case for him or her for the first time, but for everybody else the second time, unless there's somebody there, there's no virtue in scheduling re-argument. And so they're sort of in limbo until they actually know they're going to get somebody.
So what are some of the cases that stand out to you this coming term?
Well, one of those cases that they've put off until later in the term is a case they granted in the middle of the last term, and it tests whether a state constitution or law can forbid direct or indirect aid to a parochial school. In this case, it's a school, a church-run school in Missouri that wanted a grant for rubberized playgrounds using material from old tires. And it was denied a grant, even though it was certainly qualified for the grant and ranked high in qualifications for the grant. But clearly it didn't get the grant because it's a religious school, religiously run school, even though the playground has nothing to do with religion. So the question, but that's definitely indirect aid to the school. And so people who would support such a denial would say money is fungible and the taxpayers shouldn't be supporting a religious school. And the religious school would say, this is a grant that has nothing to do with religion. It only has to do with safety for kids. So that case really joins a tough issue, and it's not on the docket yet.
Any cases that are not being, that the judges have declined to hear this time around that you find significant?
Well, so far they denied hearing any of the cases where they granted a stay, I guess you should say. Didn't grant a stay to any of the election law cases that came up around this election. Now, that doesn't really mean anything except that whatever the lower court held, your voter ID law is unconstitutional. Your early voting cutback is constitutional in Ohio. Those decisions stay for this election. But you may recall that in 2013, the Supreme Court struck down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. And in the immediate aftermath of that, state legislators in a lot of states with Republican-dominated legislatures enacted a bunch of laws to make it more difficult for people who are minority and poor to vote, cutting back on early voting, requiring having very strict ID requirements. And those, for the most part, have been struck down by the lower courts. And they will make their way back to the Supreme Court after this election. And the question is whether there's a majority to decide whether those laws are should stay on the books or not.
Nina, what's going to happen with Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee to replace Antonin Scalia on the bench? He hasn't gotten a vote yet. He hasn't had hearings yet. Will he?
Well, there's at least a chance for him to have a vote and a hearing in the lame duck session of Congress if Hillary Clinton wins and if Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, agrees that they can move forward on his nomination. Although McConnell so far has said he won't allow that, that it should wait until there's a new president, whether or not it's Trump or Clinton. And that means not until January, which would mean that if it's Garland, the earliest he likely would be sitting on the court and hearing cases would be April. And if it's not Garland, it might not happen until the very end of the term. So we're likely in for another term without a ninth justice.
If it is Trump who gets to fill the seat, did it surprise you that he released a list of people that he might put on the court so early?
Well, nobody's ever done that before, that I know of anyway. But he's actually issued two lists, first a list of 11, then another list of 10. They're all very conservative, particularly socially conservative names. However, he's not committed in any way to naming somebody from those lists. That's just to give you an idea of what kind of person he wants to appoint.
Does it surprise you, just in the few seconds we have left, that the Supreme Court has not been a major issue in this presidential campaign?
It always surprises me because, and this time more than ever, because there's not a theoretical vacancy, there is a vacancy. Mm. And there's the possibility of as many as three more based on the fact that two of the current justices are over 80 and yeah. One is 78. So the next president either could make a much more liberal court for a generation to come, or a dramatically more conservative court for decades and decades, many generations.
NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Nina, thanks so much.
Thank you.